Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the strike by 40,000 Verizon workers that has drawn the support of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and examine why Verizon is cutting workers loose with nearly 40% fewer workers today than it had a decade ago. A telecommunications analyst for over 30 years, Bruce Kushnick, the chairman of Teletruth and executive director of the New Networks Initiative, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, "Verizon, CWA, and IBEW Union Members Go on Strike. America's Communications Future is at Stake," which reveals a massive fraud by the telecom monopolies, to whom customers have paid over $400 billion to build out fiber optic broadband like Fios, only to have Verizon switch that money to more profitable wireless infrastructure, resulting in the U.S. having the worst and most expensive broadband cable service in the developed world. Then we will speak with Tom Hayden, a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society, who was active in the anti-war movement, then went on to serve in the California legislature for 18 years. He now writes for the Sacramento Bee and the San Francisco Chronicle on the Brown administration's climate change policies, and we will discuss his article at The Nation, "I Used to Support Bernie, But Then I Changed My Mind," and why he now supports Hillary Clinton, as well as his concern that a terrible friction is brewing between the two Democratic camps left in the primary. Then finally, we'll hear from a supporter of Bernie Sanders, the economist James Galbraith, a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas and author of Inequality: What Everyone Needs to Know. He joins us to discuss the announcement today by the Federal Reserve and the FDIC that five of the biggest banks in the country cannot credibly be unwound without another bailout from taxpayers, and why he thinks Bernie Sanders could better rein in Wall Street banks that are now too bigger to fail. And joining us now is Bruce Kushnick, who is the chairman of Teletruth and executive director of New Networks Initiative. He has been a telecommunications analyst for over 30 years and has an article at the Huffington Post, "Verizon, CWA, and IBEW Union Members Go on Strike. America's Communications Future is at Stake." Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Kushnick.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And Verizon workers, of course, about almost 40,000 of them are on strike. And yesterday, Bernie Sanders spoke to them and Hillary Clinton joined in the picket lines. So it's getting some attention. But your analysis takes the issue much further, and that is that this company is switching from landlines, I guess, for the want of a better description, to wireless. And I've never understood why it is that Verizon, since it happened right in my neighborhood, why they suspended their Fios program or underfunded it. My understanding was that the CEO who was pushing it got eased out by Wall Street because it was proving to be too expensive, and they are all about quick returns and not long-term investments. So what is really going on there with what appears to be a disinvestment from cable, and particularly from fiber optics, and a move to wireless?
Are you in the in Los Angeles, the former GTE territory of Verizon that was sold to Frontier?
Well, West Los Angeles, I'm not sure. I mean, we actually had Time Warner, and then they got into a fight with CBS, and we got so disgusted that we were collateral damage in some corporate spat between a bunch of, you know, corporate fraternity boys, right, doing a penis measuring contest, you know. So we switched to Verizon, but then they didn't have Fios. And as you know, right, in this country, it's obscene how pathetic the cable service, the broadband service is.
Well, a couple of things. Verizon has sold off the areas of Los Angeles and a bunch of other places that it got in a merger years ago, because it was supposed to go into all the other AT&T areas and decided not to do it. And what happened was, is in those in the areas like Los Angeles, they decided to not invest. And so they basically said, so what happened was, in 2010, Verizon's leadership changed, and Lowell McAdams came from Verizon Wireless. And basically their point of view was, we can make a lot more money with wireless. and the way they make a lot more money is because the wires that they're putting in are dedicated to the wireless build out, but not the wire line, i.e., they go out and said, all right, we can make a lot more money on wireless, so why don't we have local phone customers pay for the wires to the cell towers, the wires that go into these, you know, the ones that you don't know about and they're not part of the public's viewpoint, view, and the Fios stuff, we'll just stop building that out, and we'll just tell everybody it's unprofitable to do. However, it wasn't unprofitable to do. They just decided to do this as a strategic move because they figured that they can get a lot more money per customer by the wireless side, because the wireline side, the local phone customers, would be paying for the construction if they had regular phone service. So essentially, across the United States, what happened was Verizon decided to stop building around 2010-11 Fios and essentially left most of America, their territories, unupgraded. So, and in fact, we have good relationships with a lot of the CWA and IBEW workers around the country. And they've told me stories that were just make my hair, you know, my hair stand on end. For example, upstate New York, there were supposed to be cities that were supposed to be wired with fiber optics, Fios. And essentially, they just took those union people and moved them to do the wires to the cell towers. Now, these people lived in these communities that were supposed to be wired, and they can't get Fios even though they work for the company. And so what happened was the company decided that a strategic move was we can make more money this way. We could tell people that, you know, the networks are unprofitable. We're going to shut everybody off we want, and we'll force them onto wireless. So in a lot of areas, they're claiming that they should just be able to shut off the copper wires that exist, not upgrade them, and essentially move everybody to the wireless networks. Now, the reason why they can make much more money on wireless is very straightforward. They charge you per, you know, after a certain point, they charge you per gigabit, and $10 for a package of X amount of extra capacity. And so if you were to watch regular cable service on their wireless service at home, it would cost you like $800 to $1,000. Based on the Nielsen actual viewing of services. And so essentially they go, you know, we're just going to charge people a lot more money this way, and let's just do this. The regulators are asleep at the wheel. They haven't done anything to stop any of this, and nobody's actually done any of the audits or investigations of all the money. So our position, we have a group that basically goes out and, you know, does audits, and we're calling for investigations across the country, because essentially what we believe is that they've manipulated the books and taking the money that was supposed to be used for wiring, for example, Los Angeles, to get it to have everybody have high-speed broadband, and they moved it to all the other parts of their business.
Of course, we were talking about this fact that 40,000 of Verizon workers on the East Coast are on strike, and these are the people right. Who are being cut loose from this division that they've underfunded, downsized, and moved their funds to the wireless division. But what kind of obligations and agreements did they have with these citywide cable franchise agreements that they made, and how enforceable are them? Because it's pretty clear that the consumer with broadband internet is getting hosed in this country. I mean, I'll give you an example. The city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, has a municipal broadband that is 1 gigabit, 1,000 megabytes. That's right. Just regular service. And here, these pathetic people like Time Warner are advertising on television that they'll give you like 30 megabytes as though they're doing you a favor. You know, the national average is 9 megabytes per second, which is a disgrace. And, right. And high-speed broadband, they put it into the city of Santa Monica. The people are flocking, moving their businesses there because it's standard in Japan and even in France and in South Korea. But here, where we invented the internet, we're getting hosed by these greedy SOBs.
Well, I have a book out called The Book of Broken Promises, and I go through a lot of what happened in the United States. So let me just tell you a story that you probably will make everybody get really pissed off. In the year 1991. When Clinton and Gore were running the campaign to become, you know, the president and vice president, Al Gore had a plan, which was to have what known as the information superhighway, which was to have America have fiber optics throughout the United States by the year 2010. They were supposed to have everyone have fiber optics with speeds of 45 megabits in both directions starting in 1993. Now, What happened was is what is now Verizon, what is now AT&T, what is now CenturyLink, went state by state and went to the state regulators and said, listen, we want this deal. We will rewire our territory, almost the entire state, if you just change the laws and give us more money. And we'll start doing this in 1993. So in New Jersey, for example, 100% of Verizon New Jersey, which is 96% of the entire state, was supposed to be done by the year 2010 with 45 megabit services, capable of 45 megabit services in both directions. And they basically lied in their documents that they submitted to the state claiming that they'd fulfilled their obligations. And they collected in just that one state about $15 billion. In Pennsylvania, the state next to it, they basically said the exact same thing, and they were basically supposed to have the entire their territory, Verizon Pennsylvania, done by the year 2015. Now, this is in-state law. These are state laws, state regulations and laws that were changed to give the company more money. Overall, the United States spent $400 billion by the end of 2014 to go out and have the entire United States rewired. Because state by state, they've made these agreements. In California, what was known as Pac Bell, Pacific Telesis, went to the state commission and said, listen, we're going to have 5.5 million households wired by the year 2000 with fiber optics, and we will spend $16 billion if you change the laws. They changed the laws. Pac Bell had a merger with one of the other companies, turned into SBC. SBC closed everything that was being built in California, but the regulators never went back to stop the flow of money to build these networks. This happened in pretty much every state in America. So everybody sitting here who had regular phone service paid between $4,000 and $5,000 extra per line to go out and have these things built. Now, my story is very straightforward. I was a consultant to the phone companies. I was actually rich. I was famous. I was traveling around the world. I invented the three-digit dialing, like 311. I rolled out the first one in 1992. And my clients were all the phone companies, and I happened to know that the cost models that were being submitted to the states were bordering on fraudulent. And so I tried turning them in, and that was 1992 when I started New Networks. And the reason why I tried to turn them in is I had a conscience. I didn't believe that it was good for the country to go out and pay all this money and basically not get what they paid for. And I am the living proof. Do not bite the hand that feeds you if you want to stay rich and happy. In 1992, I did a press conference at the National Press Club, and I said, "Excuse me," and I didn't know the whole story of that. I was working for the companies. I only knew pieces of it. So over the last 20 whatever years, I've been telling pretty much the same story over and over and over again. And now people are starting to realize what happened 20 years ago and 15 years ago, where we all paid for in billions of dollars per state to go out and have everything rewired, and the regulators didn't do any oversight. There's no institutional memory past about an hour and a half. So in New Jersey, for example, after the law went through, nobody ever checked. Nobody went back to we do this. We actually filed in Massachusetts in 1999, in Pennsylvania in 2003, in New York in 2006. We filed complaints saying, excuse me, you collected all this money. Where are the networks? So now the unions, who have basically been, slowly getting fired by attrition because they're saying the networks aren't profitable, all those guys are suddenly going, wait a second, we did pay for this stuff. Why aren't we getting it? And I think, that's because they're on self-interest. They want to keep their jobs, and they want to build out America. My take was we should have had the best fiber optic networks in the world by around 2000, 2005.
You said that we've already paid for it, though. That's a part of it. I mean, this is why I'm trying to just tie it into this strike. We as consumers and customers have paid for this, building out this fiber optic network. The divisions that have done that have been downsized by these companies, particularly Verizon, who've decided to switch their resources to the more profitable wireless part of their company. And now the workers are being cut loose. And it's worth noting that Verizon has 40% fewer workers now than they did a decade ago. So now the workers are getting cut loose after the consumers have been hosed and ripped off. Is that the sequence we're talking about?
Yes. And you got it right. And not only that, but the thing that's most galling is this, the regulators don't go back and say, let's do an investigation. Where's all the money? And the unions are actually starting, you know, the unions in the East Coast have filed in multiple states saying, you know, you're not only not building out the networks, you're letting the entire infrastructure of the state utility decay and fall apart, which has been going on for the last decade. The copper wires, basically, they don't pay for it anymore. They don't upgrade those wires. They basically they don't fix them even. So you have a situation where they want them to decay so they can say, well, the wires are so bad, we're just going to put you on wireless. And so the unions, it is in their self-interest to go out and get the stuff wired because it gives them more jobs. But the truth of the matter is they actually, at least on the East Coast, they've been defending the rights of customers in many of the proceedings, because basically they have been the ones saying, you know, where's the wires that we paid for? And I think that this is where the strike is very interesting, because hopefully the stories will come out, like today, talking to you. People actually need to know that these things happened, and that because the secret is we're still paying for it. Everybody who has phone service is still paying for those wires. And everybody who pays for wireless is paying for the wires, too, because the money's been diverted to go pay for the wireless networks. We've been calling for investigations and audits for the last couple of years on this topic, and we're going to be doing a lot more of this because we have a lot of data that basically has, you know, we've gotten through some of the union guys who basically said, you know, here's some things you don't know and stuff that you should, you know, make public. And so, you know, telling the story, here, now, is a great thing. And I think that needs to happen, you know, more. So that's one. Thank you for having me.
Well, no, I didn't know the full story, and I'm learning about it right now from you. I just know, as a customer, that I'm getting ripped off. Well, let's just in the last minute, though, Bruce.
Sure.
Let's just get a quick wrap up here of the main bullet points, because you know the audience is hearing this for the first time of how they actually paid for fiber optic broadband throughout the country to have all of the municipalities wired. These agreements were made with municipalities, and these big monopolies like Verizon have simply taken the money, which I guess has been levied on bills, and then they've now switched to wireless, and they're cutting back. Not only have they abandoned their promises, and nobody's getting anything like the service they want, and then on top of that, they're now trying to cut loose their employees and downsize them. And the hope we have is that the unions who are being directly affected here, that are out on strike, will be the ones that will start educating the public about how much we've all been ripped off and how there's been no regulation and how the Congress presumably has sold us out.
I think you got that right, yes.
So I don't need your summary, is that what?
Well, actually, my summary is everybody paid $4,000 or $5,000 for a fiber optic wire they didn't get, and essentially the unions at this point in time are like, you know, like the Star Wars, our last hope. This story needs to be told. I've been telling it for years and years and years. It's only because they're on strike that I think, you know, people will sort of realize there's a story here to be, you know, of how they've been harmed. And so I'm hoping that the unions, you know, tell this story and actually and it builds the unions. My position is that the union guys, if in fact I am correct, and if there are investigations, there would be more hiring of union people, not less.
Right.
They would be building the network that we need today.
Exactly. And then at the end of the day, everybody prospers. The customers get better service, and the economy prospers, because we should be getting what we're paying for. And if we had the kind of broadband that other countries have, it's an enormous boost to the economy in general. Thank you for joining us, Bruce. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. I had a good time.
And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Kushnick, who is the chairman of Teletruth and the executive director of New Networks Initiative. He's been a telecommunications analyst for over 30 years and has an article at the Huffington Post, Verizon, CWA, and IBEW union members go on strike. America's communications future is at stake. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Tom Hayden about why he used to support Bernie Sanders and now supports Hillary Clinton. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tom Hayden, the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, a founding member of the Students for Democratic Society. He was active in the anti-war movement and then went on to serve for 18 years in the California's legislature. Currently, he writes for the Sacramento Bee and the San Francisco Chronicle on the Brown administration's climate change policies. His books include The Long 60s from 1960 to Barack Obama and Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. And he has an article at The Nation, I Used to Support Bernie Sanders, But Then I Changed My Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Hayden.
Thanks. Glad to be with you, Ian.
So, Tom, in your lengthy article in The Nation, you start out by saying that you used to support Bernie Sanders, but now you're supporting Hillary Clinton, and that you're worried that a terrible friction is brewing between the two Democratic camps left in this primary. I must say, when both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were going back and forth with each other about who was the more qualified, who was qualified in general, I couldn't believe how they'd gone off the rails, both of them, in the sense that, you know, Ted Cruz is the least qualified person ever in history of the United States to run for the president of the United States. He's only effectively run in one primary race in Texas where it completely depended upon nobody showing up at the polls. So talk about unqualified and untested. So here you have these two incredibly qualified Democratic candidates by comparison to Trump and Cruz going at each other. So this could go off the rails, don't you think?
Yes. All year I've been following this with an uneasy feeling in my stomach. I finally resolved that it wasn't enough to just be for Bernie because he would push Hillary to the left. I resolved that the thing I really favored 100% was building towards a united front between these campaigns without bruising and without damage, because that would cause disaffections in the fall election for the president, the platform, and the Supreme Court. So that's where I started, and I prefer to be there myself because I've commented and talked to people in both campaigns about problems I see with both of them. But I'm a Californian. I vote with everybody else in California. So when it came down to it, I decided I couldn't vote for a united front. So I said I was going to support Hillary Clinton, and that was really for one overwhelming lifetime reason, and that is the issue of race and racism. And I'm speaking of Hillary's voters here, not necessarily her record, but it became clear to me after Nevada, where she got 100% of the black vote and won the first, multiracial primary, that he had made a choice that
would cause great trouble. He chose to run in states and primaries and caucuses that were white dominated, like his native state of Vermont, of course, and that he made a second priority, a later priority, on going after the black vote, because it was overwhelmingly clear to me from the votes and from both the California Latino caucus and congressional caucus, who I'm long affiliated with, that they were for him. And Bernie has risen in the polling in terms of black votes subsequently. But even in Michigan, where Bernie won, it's a white state, and Hillary got 65% of the black vote. And that seems to be a pattern, and it leads to a fact. The fact is that she's probable winner in the delegate count, and the other fact is that she wins propelled by black and Latino and union votes. And I have to look myself in the mirror and ask, well, can I turn my back on communities that I've spent 60 years of my life living in or working in, the African-American communities? I got 70% of the black vote in running for mayor here, and only 21% of the white vote. And I've long supported immigrant rights and, you know, the civil rights movement all the way through Black Lives Matter. And I've been deeply occupied with solving the gang problem in Los Angeles and around the country, and with police reform consent decrees, which we were able to achieve at the LAPD. So, and my family is multiracial or interracial, interracial, if you wish, and can't do it. It wouldn't be me. Whether they're right or wrong, the black consensus and the brown consensus is what it is, and I'm with them. I cannot look at them and say, no, you guys are wrong. I'm for the other ticket here, because the other ticket is overwhelmingly the white left and the white liberals. And Bernie's chosen, or it's been imposed on him by history, to run a campaign which, if he wins, will be a defeat for the black and Latino communities. Can't do that. Sorry.
But Tom Hayden, what about the young? They seem to be disproportionately flocking to Bernie. What do you make of that?
I think Bernie's historical achievement is to raise a new generation in response to the Wall Street crash and the dominance of banks and corporate money over politics, and hopefully they'll go a very long way. But my affiliation, my loyalty, my life is about race, and Bernie is doing well lately in the black community. But still, even in New York, the black support for Hillary is running 60%, 70%, 2-1, and notwithstanding Harry Belafonte or Cornel West or you know, any number of important black writers, Michelle Alexander. You know, they just are not in consensus mode with the black voting population, not only in the South but in the North, and it can be for many reasons, a lot of them internal. But I think what it has to do with is that Bernie made a choice, and Bernie started late and couldn't afford to do both at once, and fell behind, and it's hard for him to catch up. It's a fact. And you know, I salute the young people. They'll probably think that's patronizing, and that's fine with me. Their vote for Bernie, it will be admirable, and The most important thing is unity, followed by the strongest role that Bernie can achieve, whether he wins or loses the primary. He's made a mark, and his new generation of voters will come to power in 4 or 8 years, I'm sure.
And again, I'm speaking with Tom Hayden, who's the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City. He's a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society and was active in the anti-war movement and went on to serve for 18 years in the California legislature. Currently, he writes for the Sacramento Bee and the San Francisco Chronicle on the Brown administration's climate change policies. And his books include The Long 60s from 1960 to Barack Obama and Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters. And he has an article at The Nation, I Used to Support Bernie, But Then I Changed My Mind. So your article, of course, is about essentially about how you're going to vote in the California primary. And
I have to vote, so yeah. I had to make up my mind. I wanted to vote for a united front, but I can't do that.
Right. But the fact that there is a California primary is finally relevant. That's a part of the problem, the way you see it, I take it.
No.
You don't?
I think, as I write in the article, I think Bernie has a real chance to win in California.
Mm-hmm.
I don't predict these things, but I would call it a real chance. And I still think that
you don't want the competition to be over, which is what a lot of the establishment wants, right?
No. Bernie's and Bernie's campaign have every reason to fight to the finish, absolutely. But all of us have to vote along the way, and I'm afraid that by endorsing Hillary, I've antagonized enough Bernie voters that the United Front is fraying, and I see increasing tension and hostility between the two campaigns, which is in the nature of the end game in a primary, but it shouldn't have to be. For example, I get very reasonable and rational letters defending Bernie and arguing against my choice, and I appreciate that, and I answer every single one of them. I get people that say, you've changed my mind. Thank you very much. And then there's a group of people, I don't know who they are, you may encounter them online, but there's a section of the Bernie movement that is like a coiled and poisonous snake ready to attack anyone that whispers a bad word about Bernie. And I don't know how that's productive for them. I mean, for example, one friend of mine was emailing the other day, before I shut the email down, that she had heard that I had lost my mind because I'd had a stroke 11 months ago. All I can say is, listeners can listen to me and determine whether my mind is clear. But it's that kind of reasoning, that is infectious on the left and very self-destructive. There's a good case for Bernie. There's a case for Hillary. I've made my decision, and so be it.
So when you write, Tom Hayden, that Bernie comes from a place that is familiar to me, the New York culture of democratic socialism, elaborate on that, if you will.
There's not much more to say. I wrote it. I mean,
yeah.
I'm a Midwestern Catholic.
Uh-huh.
I was a student editor. I was attracted to the civil rights movement in 1960. I went to Fayetteville, Tennessee. I went to Macomb, Mississippi. Got beaten up. Went to Atlanta. Got dragged away by Lester Maddox with holding an axe. And so my roots go deep into that particular generation. Also, I was a field secretary for a fledgling social democratic organization, which was finally named the SDS. And our, quote, elders at the time were all Socialist Party people who were totally anti-communist, and they fired us, including Michael Harrington, one of my friends and heroes. They fired us for not being anti-communist enough. And they went on to push for the Vietnam War, which was the catastrophe of my lifetime. So I'm very familiar with the arguments about social democracy, socialism, Stalinism, Trotskyism. I'm familiar with that culture. SDS chose, at least then, not to be an explicitly socialist organization, but to recognize socialism's value for its deeper critique of the system that we lived under, while at the same time we wanted to bond with liberals because they were taking relevant action, you know, like the AFL-CIO, the March on Washington, and so on. So we always thought the two had to be linked somehow in a synthesis, but it would be a mistake to say that SDS was a socialist organization. We were actually caught up in these entanglements, which really soured many of us. And we don't like to, or people like myself don't like to revisit that kind of sectarianism. I think Bernie is actually from that world. I know it well, and he actually is a New Dealer. I mean, he's a Franklin Roosevelt New Dealer, and that's what the Port Huron Statement was about, to expand, deepen, and democratize the New Deal. And I've always been in favor of public ownership of the oil and gas industries and, you know, major communications industries. And always had a concern to make sure that any socialist movement was bottom-up and could deal with the bureaucracy of the state, which was always an alarm. So I was kind of like, if any kind of socialist, I was kind of like Noam Chomsky's libertarian socialist.
So just in closing then, Tom, is that any of that to say that you have drifted away from Bernie Sanders, or has he gone in one direction, you in the other? You are,
no,
after all.
I don't have any antagonism with him. I have made my judgment that I'm overwhelmingly following the lead of the Black and Latino caucus, the labor movement, 15 out of 20 internationals, a lot of them representing these workers there for Hillary. So if Kevin De Leon, the Senate leader in Sacramento, tells me that they're uniting for Hillary, I have to take that seriously. If my friends in Washington, in the Congressional Black Caucus, including Maxine Waters and many others, tell me they're uniting for Hillary, I have to take that seriously. What am I supposed to do? Turn and say, no, you're really wrong, and I'm right. No, all my life I've avoided that kind of leaning. And, you know, even if they are wrong, these are the people whose word I follow. They have the final word. If people have their passionate concerns, for example, about Hillary's stand on the Honduran coup and the murder of Ms. Aceres, I share that, and I would encourage them to vote for Bernie if that's their highly important concern to them at the moment. I still go with the Black and Latino and labor caucuses as far as this primary is concerned. I'm not going to turn my back on people of a lifetime. And I don't mean the younger people say is the establishment, like, oh, well, you know, John Lewis, he's establishment. Dolores Huerta, she's establishment. You know, when they tell me that they're uniting for Hillary, I have to pay attention. And a lot of them are younger than me, and they're more divided, and they're becoming the future. But the facts are overwhelming here that This is a primary that's going to be settled by the vote of communities of color, and if it's not, that's that too. I'll struggle on.
Well, Tom Hayden, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Tom Hayden, who's the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society. He was active in the anti-war movement and went on to serve for 18 years in the California legislature. Currently, he writes for the Sacramento Bee and the San Francisco Chronicle on the Brown administration's climate change policies. And his latest article at The Nation is, "I used to support Bernie, but then I changed my mind." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the economist James Galbraith about how the banks are now too bigger to fail and why he supports Bernie Sanders. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Galbraith, professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. His latest books are Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Thanks very much.
And we were just speaking with Tom Hayden, who is changed his mind and instead of supporting Bernie Sanders is now supporting Hillary Clinton. He has a lengthy article in The Nation explaining why he's made this choice. You, I take it, are a supporter of Bernie Sanders, and in many ways, being a prominent economist, I take it your main reasons have to do with Bernie Sanders' position on Wall Street.
I'm a stalwart supporter of Bernie Sanders, and his economic positions are very important in that, and of course, amongst them, the position on Wall Street is of particular importance. I have to say, I did read Tom Hayden's article. I thought his case for changing was really quite weak. It rests it on civil rights issues, and of course, Bernie Sanders was part of the civil rights movement as far back as 1961. He has got nothing to apologize for on that issue.
So in terms of support for Bernie's position on Wall Street, it would seem to me that what just was revealed today by the Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation announcing that the five of the nation's eight largest banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase and the Bank of America, do not have credible plans of how they would unwind themselves down in a crisis without sowing panic. In other words, they are still too big to fail. That is big news, and surely that buttresses in many ways the position that Bernie Sanders has been taking all along, that we could be bailing these banks out again. And what did it cost us last time? $13 trillion or something?
Well, the cost was enormous, and the loss to the economy from what the banks did was extraordinary. And I think this is, in fact, one of the most important and fundamental issues that are before Democratic voters in this campaign. It is an issue that relatively clearly separates Senator Sanders from Secretary Clinton, and one in which there has been an interesting debate in recent weeks, recent days, on the question. I know that my old friend Paul Krugman has kind of lined up behind the idea that the big banks were not fundamental to the financial crisis. He's quite wrong about that. The big banks were the vector that transmitted the incredibly corrupt and disastrous mortgage practices out in California, in particular of firms like Countrywide and IndyMac and so forth, to the broader financial system. They're the ones who bought the mortgages, packaged them, got them fraudulently rated as AAA mortgages, and sold them with fraudulent representations and warranties to the investment community. So they are at the center of the problem, and the fact that they are unmanageable is now very clearly been made, not only really across the spectrum. It's something which has been made by Senator Sanders. It's been made by the official regulators. It's been made by people who had experience of the crisis, running the crisis in the Bush administration. This guy, Neel Kashkari, who's now the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota. So there is a very broad agreement, I think, transpartisan agreement that this issue is, in fact, an important one, and that Bernie Sanders is on the right side of it.
And you mentioned Paul Krugman. Of course, it seems that Senator Elizabeth Warren, without referring to Paul Krugman by name, talked about revisionist history of the financial crisis, which seemed to be a thinly veiled rebuke. This is, again, pretty hard news to ignore, given the source
that
being
long ago, and memories have not faded that much. The points I just made, the idea that somehow Angelo Mozzillo of Countrywide was able to dupe the big banks into buying the crap that he was peddling is truly extraordinary. If that was the case, then the banks should be broken up on grounds of incompetence alone. But it wasn't the case. The fact is they knew what they were buying, and they bought it willfully, and they should be broken up on grounds of essentially of corruption.
And as I say, you couldn't have more credible warnings from the more credible sources than the Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So given that Bernie Sanders, in your opinion, James Galbraith, is on the right track and that the situation on Wall Street and the frailty of these two bigs, these banks that are not just too big to fail, but they're even too bigger to fail since they've gotten bigger since the public bailed them out in what I believe is the largest transfer of private debt into public debt in the history of the planet. How is Bernie Sanders then going to implement the changes? Do you see that he has the ability, given what's happened with Obama, the obstruction on that he's been faced with this recalcitrant Just Say No Congress? What kind of job would Bernie Sanders do that would be any better than what Barack Obama's managed to do with the likes of Mitch McConnell and others who are determined to grind everything to a halt?
I'm prepared to wait until Bernie Sanders is inaugurated and see what the political landscape looks like after that rather remarkable event occurs. At that time, a President Sanders will have an enormous amount of moral authority and political capital. And he can go to the Treasury Department and he can say, Mr. Secretary, what authorities do you have under the law to fix the banking system? He can use those authorities that are available under Dodd-Frank and other legislation. And whatever is required beyond that, he can go to the Congress and say, as Ronald Reagan said when he was elected in 1980, look, I've just been elected president. Elections have meaning. This is what I want you to do. And then the Congress, I don't think we give up at that point, but it's because of somebody like Mitch McConnell stands in the schoolhouse door and says, no, nothing can be reformed. This will be a political process at that time, which will have a very considerable backing of a very large part of the American public. And if somebody wants to say, no, I'm not going to go along, well, they can face the judgment of the public on what they're doing.
Well, we'll be hearing from both candidates in about 15 minutes from now, James Galbraith, and in their ninth debate. And I do recall in a more recent debate, about this issue of Wall Street and who's got more credibility in reforming Wall Street, and Hillary Clinton, in defending charges from Bernie Sanders, said that exactly what you just said, that there is a mechanism in place, like the such as the Dodd-Frank legislation, that could wind down these problems and bring these banks to heel. So she has actually said what you just said.
Fine. And then the question is she prepared to commit now to use that power? But there's another issue here that really, I think, strongly separates Secretary Clinton from Senator Sanders. And that is the question of whether they are aligned with the interests and the personnel of the large Wall Street institutions, of the big banks. This has been a problem for Democratic administrations going back to the Clinton years, that they have essentially drawn their economic policy leadership from that community, from that group of people. This would not happen under a Sanders administration. And we can hear from Secretary Clinton whether she would pledge that it would not happen under a Clinton administration going forward. But I think there's a record there that would lead people to really have questions about the credibility of any such claim. It's a very clear division between the two candidates. And I think it's fundamentally one that the Democratic Party needs to resolve at the ballot box. This is what Democrats are being asked to vote on. Do you want a nominee who is has a history and a record of having been aligned with the major banks, or do you want a nominee that has a record and a history of having taken the opposite side, the side of sense of Main Street against the side of Wall Street? That's a historical difference, and one which matters. It's a difference of first order policy.
And do you think, James Galbraith, that Hillary Clinton's husband's tenure in the White House is fair game in this, in regard to what we're talking about? Because obviously Bill Clinton's been criticized for the undoing of the Glass-Steagall Act, which many see as certainly the beginning of the unraveling that happened in 2008. And in the very last, I believe, week of his presidency, under pressure from all people, Phil Gramm, who's the economic advisor now to Ted Cruz, who, along with others, have been lobbying heavily for what's called the Enron loophole, which was to deregulate derivatives. President Clinton, in the last week of his presidency, caved in, and I don't know what happened there. Frankly, it's not.
Well, my understanding is that bill had the support of the Clinton administration, and that he did sign it, the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, it was called, which made it illegal, effectively, for the U.S. government to regulate credit default swaps and derivatives of that kind. So this was a these acts of the Clinton administration were the deregulation, which was followed in the Bush administration by desupervision, by pulling back the supervisors, and that between the two things led to the explosion of fraudulent mortgages and ultimately to the meltdown of the banking system. Is that fair game for Secretary Clinton? Of course, it's fair game to ask her what is her view of those measures. Does she believe or not believe that they were as I've just described, the foundations of the disaster? Has she learned the lessons of this situation? Even given what she might say in response to that, one has, I think, a very clear distinction between the two candidates, because in Bernie Sanders' case, it is obviously clear that he understands the lessons of this situation. It's obviously clear that he recognizes that we need to have a financial institution, a financial system, which is under effective authority of competent and autonomous regulators, and that is not being regulated by people who are drawn from the industry itself.
So obviously, we're speaking before Tuesday's big primary in New York, and then followed by Pennsylvania, and then Tom Hayden was talking about he's voting for Hillary in the California primary, where, you know, California primary is usually irrelevant, but this time around, in terms of Democrats, it may well be relevant, and also for Republicans, I presume, given that these primary races are still pretty tight, even though both Trump and Hillary Clinton have a lead in delegates. How do you address then the issue that Tom Hayden, the fratricide, the one that he's mostly concerned about, is that there's this animus between the Clinton and Bernie camp is going to hurt Democrats in the general? Do you see that as a problem?
Well, I think you have to fight this out in the primaries. You get a decision at the convention, and you go forward from there. I think gaming the situation in advance is a bad idea. California voters, like every voter, should choose the candidate they think will best represent their interests. And in the case of California, one has to remember that California was effectively ground zero of the foreclosure epidemic that followed the crisis. Many, many hundreds of thousands, millions of people lost their homes. And this is the consequence on the ground of having allowed the financial system to slip out of control.
So, but I, for example, brought up my kind of annoyance that both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were each accusing the other of not being qualified, which is an absurd idea, given that they're both, she's particularly qualified and he's extremely qualified in terms of having run in a number of races, as has she, compared to Cruz, who's has only effectively run in one race where he got incredibly lucky because it depended upon nobody showing up, and they changed the time till the heat of summer in Texas and nobody did show up. And here he is now, poised to, in his second election, in effect, will be for president of the United States. And you've also got the other character, Donald Trump, who's, we don't even have to get into that. I mean, so I thought it was the height of absurdity that these two Democrats were arguing about who's qualified when, in compared to the Republicans, they are immensely qualified.
Well, this was an inflammatory thing that was said from behind a veil of anonymity by a senior, apparently a senior staffer or staffers in the Clinton camp right after the Wisconsin primary to a CNN reporter who then reported it out. That was ill-advised was very clear from the beginning. This has obviously been and continues to be a campaign where you've got two candidates with deep political experience who have significant differences on policy questions. The Democratic Party needs to choose between them. As you say, on the Republican side, they are not quite so fortunate, and they're not quite so blessed with let's say, a deep bench. And they've got Mr. Trump, who's a real estate man, and Senator Cruz, who is a product of the Federalist Society, and a very capable advocate, by the way, but one who's an absolute newcomer, on the political stage. They're welcome to those two gentlemen, if you ask me.
So you're not worried that the Dems are going to go off the rails again?
I think that once one goes past the convention, that almost anything can happen. And I don't think the outcome of the election can be taken for granted by any means. But I think at this point it is too clever by half to try and game the situation by saying that this candidate or that candidate should be nominated because they're less likely to be vulnerable to whatever may happen, whatever may be said after the election. What Democratic voters should do is choose the one they think best represents their interests, the one who has the proposals that provide for the better future. And we've talked about the financial sector. There's clear differences there. But Bernie Sanders has also laid out very clearly his proposals for education, his proposals for health care, his proposals for a $15 minimum wage. There are differences between Sanders and Clinton on all of those issues. And that, again, is a question where voters should simply go into the voting booth and choose the candidate they think will more effectively advance their interests.
Well, James Galbraith, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. A pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who's a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His latest book is Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.